Welcome to the Pregnancy Help Podcast. I'm Christine Grimmett, and this is the first of two episodes that we're publishing on what pregnancy help organizations and even really the general public should know on chemical abortion. I have Jarell Godsey, president of Heartbeat International, here with me, as well as our special guest, Carol Novielli, contributor for Live Action News and research fellow for Live Action. Carol has over 30 years of research experience on abortion, Planned Parenthood, and eugenics, and we are so grateful to have her on with us to shed light on chemical abortion throughout its history and the general acceptance of it by medical associations. Before we get started, I want to mention that the Abortion Pill Rescue Network has a 24/7 helpline and stands ready to assist women who regret taking the abortion pill and would like a chance to continue on with their pregnancies. Statistics show that more than 5,000 babies have been rescued by abortion pill reversal. If you're interested in more information about supporting or joining the network, visit aprnworldwide.com. Jarell and Carol, thank you so much for being here, and I'll turn things over to you to get us started.
Thanks, Christine. I'm really glad to have Carol. There are writers that I say I don't ever want to miss anything that they write, and Carol is one of those. I'm grateful that she's on the team of our friends at Live Action. She's done a phenomenal job for the pregnancy help community in exposing some of the things that we just don't tend to know unless someone helps dig it up and piece it together and then lay it out for us. And Carol does not only does that, but does it in a great way to help us understand. So when we were talking about really trying to kind of explore really what pregnancy help organizations should know about chemical abortion, Carol was the first person that came to mind to say, let's reach out and let's have her join us. So thank you, Carol, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm a context person. Like, it's actually one of the top five things on my strengths finders is like setting the context for our conversation or things that I encounter. And there is so much context to this chemical abortion reality that we have to actually go back in history quite a bit. And I'm talking about even before the actual FDA. We're going to get to that as well. But let's go back in history, Carol. Help us understand, like, where did this come from? Why is it even on our radar today? How did it come about? Give us some of that, the early understanding of that story.
Sure. Well, the abortion pill came to us under the name RU486. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. But it was developed in the 1980s by a French endocrinologist. See, I can't even speak it out, but I will try to say his name, Etienne-Emile Belou. I don't speak French. And he was consulting for the French pharmaceutical company, Roussel-Uclef, which was jointly owned by the French government and another company called Hearst AG. Okay. What's interesting about those company names is that Hearst was actually part of the breakup of a company called IG Farben, which was the company that developed another chemical, cyanide gas, that was used in the German Holocaust to kill the Jews in the concentration camp called Zyklon B. So this company, Roussel-Uclef, is a subsidiary of another company, Hearst AG, which came from the breakup of IG Farben, which developed this chemical cyanide gas that killed the Jews in the Holocaust. And so as you can see, this is starting to like already get really interesting and dark. But in the 1980s, Belou developed RU486, RU for Roussel-Uclef, and 486 for the last three numbers of the drugs of the drug. And in 1988, France became the first country to approve the drug. And then there were several other countries that approved it shortly after, like China, the United Kingdom, Sweden, and then there was a host of others. At this point, the United States has still not approved the drug. So into the late 90s, this whole sort of controversy was starting to develop. And Roussel-Uclef was aware that they had you know, interests in the United States. And they were a little leery, as we were, of bringing this chemical pill into the country. There was even, you know, a lot of people were exposing the fact that two drugs that killed humans were now coming, you know, basically from the root of the same country. And even Belou, he made the comment about, you know, he was getting accused of, you know, developing a drug that was just exterminating children in the womb. And so in the late 1980s, President George Bush at the time, he put a moratorium on this drug coming into the United States. And that's where we were for quite a while.
That would be George H.W. Bush, right? That's Bush 41.
Correct.
To distinguish from Bush 43, which would be George W. Bush, which is later in the 2000s. So yeah, I'm just making sure for me for the we get the right Bush. So George H.W. Bush puts a moratorium on this drug in the late 80s during his administration.
He does. And so there's a lot of, you know, controversy about the drug as it's being approved in other countries, and there's clinical trials happening in other countries. And even here in the United States, I personally picketed the French consulate in Miami to oppose that drug coming into the country. And so Rusalucleft did not really want to approve it here. There was a time when there was some things that were attributed as violence with regard to abortion. And they were really nervous about, you know, upending their interests here because they did manufacture other pharmaceuticals. And so there was all of this kind of happening behind the scenes. And even Jerome Lejeune, if I'm saying that right, he who discovered the genetic basis of the Down syndrome, it is New York Times quotes him as saying at the time that RU-46 was the, quote, first anti-human pesticide, unquote. And he said he predicted that it would kill, quote, more human beings than Hitler, Mao, and Stalin combined. So we can talk about those numbers as we move forward to see if that's coming true. But the Pill Act did not literally enter into the United States until the 1990s, and it came in under the Bill Clinton administration. When he was elected, one of the first things he did in January 22nd, 1993, which was at the anniversary of Roe versus Wade at the time, is he issued a whole host of executive orders, you know, fetal tissue research. There was a whole litany of them, and it was very, I remember, you know, being very discouraged on that day because so many protections that we had in place for the babies were being upended by the president. And so he signed this executive order directing the FDA to expedite the marketing of RU-486. What's interesting, a little bit of behind the scenes, is that in 1992, a letter was sent to the president, authored by a man by the name of Ron Weddington. And so that name might sound familiar to some of you, especially the last name. Ron Weddington was co-counsel with his wife, Sarah Weddington, on the Roe versus Wade decision. And Sarah argued in favor of abortion before the Supreme Court. So he sends this letter in 1992 to the future President Bill Clinton, where he's advocating abortion, birth control, other sterility type things, family planning. And he talks about the need to, quote, eliminate certain segments of society using abortion pills like RU-46 and other means. And this letter was uncovered by Judicial Watch in a FOIA that they had requested. And they have it on their website under, I haven't checked recently, but it was called the Clinton Files at the time. And it's a really eye-opening letter because it really shows you kind of the mentality behind the scenes. And we see this over and over again with history of Planned Parenthood. We see it with the history of a lot of the organizations and players we'll be talking about in the coming moments or maybe in the next episode. And we'll be, you know, we see this eugenic sort of population control mindset that they're all in.
Because that's language that comes from us from Margaret Sanger back in, you know, years before this. I mean, he's essentially parroting those almost that same sentiment that Margaret Sanger had, you know, back many years before this, that he's doing in this letter to Clinton.
Sanger, and I mean, honestly, there's a whole lot of players on the eugenic side of things because Margaret Sanger was actually like the lower, she was almost a more of an outcast to the eugenics movement, if you can even believe that, than the people that were really, really ingrained in it, which included one of Planned Parenthood's, you know, past presidents, Alan Guttmacher, and he's a player in this as well too. And so we have, Sanger's big eugenicist, but the amount of players that were going on in that day, because they were looking, you know, all the time, you know, eugenics, of course, is something that, you know, goes way back to the 1800s and trying to limit population. When you look at Margaret Sanger, you realize that she was an advocate, not so much of abortion, because at the time in her world, when she was advocating eugenics, abortion was more dangerous because we didn't have, you know, infection controls and things that were really important. So even pregnancy, a lot of things were, any type of surgery was a little bit, was a lot more risky. And so Sanger, just like, she loved just to advocate for like permanent, you know, just permanently sterilize. And then eugenicists were doing the same thing. We had eugenics boards, we had sterilization boards. And so, yes, this mindset that stems from these, this mentality that they've written about, that they've bragged about, and that up until recently, a lot of these people are just now recently being called out. But the pro-life movement has been very well aware of this mindset. And I always say abortion is tethered to eugenics. That's what I always say. It is a, it is just the next step. In fact, there's some comments to that effect that I'll share with you. And so Ron Weddington basically tells President-to-be Bill Clinton, quote, "You can start immediately to eliminate the barely educated," right? Who do they always target? "Unhealthy and poor segment of our country. No, I'm not advocating some sort of mass extinction of these unfortunate people." Of course, right? They never are. "Crime, drugs, and disease are already doing that," he says. He also cites and says that his wife, Sarah, he says, "Sarah and I have been discussing the notion of setting up this like nonprofit corporation to license and distribute RU-46. And he, and then he goes on to say 26 million food stamp recipients is more than the economy can stand. So here we have that whole mentality of like, you know, we got to get rid of the poor. And he actually says this later on. He says, you know, the government is going to have to provide abortions, period, end of story. And then he goes on to say, "Our survival depends upon developing a population where everyone contributes. We don't need more cannon fodder. We don't need more parishioners. We don't need more cheap labor. We don't need more poor babies." I mean, how much more direct can you get? And so you see that, you know, even though abortion is used by the wealthy and others, it is very much, even back in this day in the abortion pill, when you look at the history, has a target of, you know, the same type of populations, the minorities, the poor people, immigrants, all of the same people that, you know, like you were talking about before, eugenicists like Margaret Sanger targeted. And so
well,
this,
you also, I mean, even in connecting it to Cyclone B, the same rationale that Weddington is voicing in this letter in 1992 was the very rationale that was being voiced in the Reichstag in Germany. We have to deal with the those that are a drain on our society, right? Those that are infirmed, those that are criminals. And, you know, we know, and we know, I had the, I won't say privilege, but the emotional moment to be standing on a little plaque that's outside of the Berlin Symphony that describes the you know, the place where they first used Zyklon B, when they basically connected a like a recirculation pump into a bus for the for those that had been kept in hospitals, you know, those that were in, you know, had some kind of like long-term disability, that those that were somehow mentally challenged, they basically processed, put on the bus, drove them into the forest right near where this plaque is, and the, you know, it's near the they call it the Tiergarten, and the, and it's where then they basically processed them and killed them with that Cyclone B, which then goes on to become part of the Final Solution, which we all know from our history books. But this is the very language that's now being spoken, not in some country that's across the ocean, but to the president of, well, what is what be, who becomes the president of the United States from the really the abortion industry, or I would say leaders at this time. Wow.
Right. And it's not shocking, because, you know, this mindset was very prevalent. There was a lot of discussion in these, you know, in the early days. You had even leading up to the legal, or the, I call it the decriminalization of abortion, prior to the Roe versus Wade decision, there was a lot of discussion. Do we use coercion, or do we use volunteerism? And you had people like Alan Guttmacher, who was promoting this concept of volunteerism. And what they were saying is, if people didn't glom onto the idea of abortion, of using it and doing it on their own, we would be willing to coerce, to force it. Things like dropping sterilants in the water of, quote, urban neighborhoods. And there's the person who wrote that, who put that into a study, turned out to be one of the another player in this whole saga of the abortion pill. And yeah, there's a whole lot that happens. In fact, when you talk about Nazi Germany, there's discussion even among historians as to whether the United States eugenics movement influenced Germany or Germany influenced them, because the founders of the American eugenics movement, which, you know, is a whole amazing history in and of itself, and their ties to Margaret Sanger. A lot of people don't know this, but the, you know, the eugenic societies literally gave free rent to Planned Parenthood once Planned Parenthood had changed its name in 1942, after they had changed their name to Planned Parenthood. Previous to that, they were under Margaret Sanger's American Birth Control League. So, I mean, this can go in so many different directions, because the history, the further out you get, the wider and wider you look at this, it has such an evil, wicked origin that, you know, when people really, if they really were to understand where it comes from and understand the targeting that's going on here, they would be horrified. So, and then, you know, like anytime that we're belittling human life, of course, we're taking part in that mentality of eugenics and population control. And so, you know, back to the present here. So, you know, Bill Clinton literally put pressure on Roussel, Roussel being the one that developed the RU-46. He put pressure on Roussel to assign U.S. marketing and distribution of the drug to another organization called the Population Council, which I say, this is another organization that has eugenic, you know, I always call them the eugenic founded Population Council. They were founded in 1952 by John D. Rockefeller III, who some would say is one of the fathers of the eugenics movement. And they literally set up the company Danco Laboratories, which was in charge of the manufacturing within the United States, clinical trials and all of this other stuff. So they set that company up. It was a single entity company. All it did was manufacture or oversee the manufacturing of this drug. Their second president, this is where that quote comes in I was mentioning earlier, Frederick Osborne, he became president in 57. He was a founding member of the American Eugenics Society. He also signed Margaret Sanger's, quote, committee, Citizens Committee for Planned Parenthood, that was published in her Birth Control Review in 1938. He once wrote, get this, eugenic goals are most likely attained under a name other than eugenics, right? So wonder what that would be, right? Birth control, abortion, right? This was just the evolution of eugenics. It's all tethered together. Another president in this list, his name was Bernard Burleson, and he's the one that published this paper that sort of quotes all of these movers and shakers in the abortion movement talking about volunteerism versus force versus coercion. And in that paper, it's discussed that if voluntary methods of birth control and abortion are not successful, then the government should, quote, put fertility control agents, quote, in the waters of urban neighborhoods. And then sitting on the Population Council's first advisory board, none other than former Planned Parenthood president Alan F. Guttmacher, who Guttmacher is the one that I would say is the primary mover and shaker to get and convince Planned Parenthood into committing abortions. They were literally later on the scene. They didn't come into abortion as quickly as other organizations. So here he is, and Guttmacher is just everywhere in this whole world. A lot of these people just sort of swam together, and they were on multiple organizations. And the Population Council was funded by, you know, known abortion philanthropists like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation. And so this is what we see starting to happen. And this is in the 1994, when this sort of starts to take place. And shortly thereafter, they begin clinical trial of the drug. And, you know, and of course, you know, just to reiterate again, Population Council sets up Danco, which is was at the time, you know, like registered in the Cayman Islands. It was a highly secretive organization. There was so much happening behind the scenes that even the even journalists, I'm literally frantically combing through notes here to find the quotes, but we had journalists at the time, Washington Post, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, talking about how secret this company was. And they couldn't find investors. They couldn't find the people that were in charge of it. And it sort of remained pretty secret secretive, even, you know, up until this time, where there's been a lot of speculation about where the drug has even been manufactured. And at one point, shortly after the drug was approved in 2000, we find out that it was manufactured at that point in China. And then we'll talk about where the speculation is that it's being manufactured now later. But in 96, they had all this trouble getting investors. So you have the single entity pharmaceutical company, Danco Laboratories. It's all they're doing is like manufacturing abortion pills, and they're in clinical trial and they can't get investors. And so Coming to the Rescue is another abortion philanthropist organization by the name of David and Lucille Packard Foundation. And they seed Danco with a $14.2 million investment to keep it afloat when it, quote, ran short of funds. Others that were known by the media, and again, any other investors, in fact, there's a really interesting research article by Mother Jones, which is in a pro-life, you know, publication at all, where they came up, they did find a bunch of other investors, and I just have not had the time to comb through it, but this is much later on. But at this point, the only thing that's really coming out in the media is the fact that we have the Packard Foundation making investment, and we have organizations like the Warren Buffett Foundation making investment in clinical trial. We also have some media outlets reporting that George Soros's Open Society is, and a very, very limited few were saying the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is, I think, just Kaiser, KFF now, was making a contribution. So whether or not Kaiser was or wasn't, but it was reported by the media at the time.
So these are some of the biggest names that we would know today. You know, Buffett, you know, billionaire Gates, you mentioned Bill and Linda Gates Foundation at the time. You have the Packard Foundation, which is part of the Hewlett Packard. You know, these are the beneficiaries of the technology booms in the particularly in the 80s, but 70s and 80s. Yep, Silicon Valley. So you have, well, of course, the Ford Foundation has been involved, as you mentioned, Kellogg Foundation. These are older, longer standing monies that have been behind this. The Rockefellers, of course, when you mention the Rockefeller, that's a name that we know from history is one of wealth. A Republican, actually. This is where this is not always easy to divide. It certainly should go back in history between, as we would say now, red and blue. It was actually a very diverse. We have many Republicans who are in on the, you know, if not in on this, they certainly are in on supporting abortion. It's only later that the Democrats basically capture this as a key thing and begin to even primary their own and push out pro-lifers. You know, we used to have a term called blue dog Democrats, which were fiscally liberal Democrats, but socially conservative. You know, that sometimes they were referred to as Dixiecrats. We would have this. We don't have this now. We now have more of the Democrat Party really taking the issue or the right to abortion as an issue. And then in general, the Republican Party is the only place. So it's only really in recent years that we have that kind of distinctive between the two parties. That really has come about in the last, what would you say, the last 20 or 25 maybe years.
Reagan may have turned some things around. But even Reagan, you know, he helped decriminalize it as governor of California.
As California, which would have been 67, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of Republicans that have played a role. In fact, you know, there's some really interesting, I don't even know if I can say it on the show, really interesting history with George Bush Sr. The Bush grandfather, or father to Sr., his name was Prescott Bush, and he was on the board of Planned Parenthood. Mm. Now, he was on the board prior to Planned Parenthood committing abortions, but still involved in all this stuff. And then, but you have the Rockefeller family heavily involved in, you know, politics, especially in New York and the decriminalization of abortion there. You know, Alan Guttmacher was playing a huge role of that in that decriminalization process in New York. You have, you know, if you really want to get some juicy stuff on the Republican mindset, because eugenics and racism go hand in hand, you know, so I think you have to look at people on an individual basis when you're looking at politicians. But you know, I did the background research for the documentary film Ma'afa 21, and we played President Richard Nixon's tapes, which are shocking. And this is just prior to the Roe versus Wade decision. And he set up this whole committee to study abortion, where he put a lot of these, you know, pro-abortion Republicans on it. And just some of the statements that he makes just a few years, you know, just in that era prior to the legalization of abortion, which tend to go right along with this idea of keeping down, you know, poor children, keeping the poor from reproducing. And so this isn't just a Republican Democrat in the history of it. It really was, you know, very entrenched in our culture and in our mindset. And, you know,
you've heard of the, was it Johnson LBJ that had the created the war on poverty, right? But in actuality, this whole kind of, I hear this term tossed around and always kind of question, like, one, is it how true it is? But you're really giving us some examples about how true this idea of like the Washington elites or the elites of our society making these decisions. That's exactly. So it's not the war on poverty. It's really becomes the war on the poor. You know, if we can so-called eliminate them before they become a drain on society. This is the kind of conversation, like, they're publishing, like you said, white papers on this stuff. So then they're the players in the background as it now begins to kind of get anchored in the, at least in the political spheres, when you were looking at the Clinton administration and saying yes. And then in partnership, like, these are the kind of deals, like backdoor deals, where now the Population Council sets up this separate corporation called Danko Pharmaceuticals, which is one product, you said, which really was the abortion pill, mifepristone. And now we're in full on in the middle of the Clinton administration, and how he's driving things forward. And what's the next kind of turn? I mean, I know where it ends up at the end of his administration, but I know there's some twists and turns along the way.
Yeah. So, I mean, he sends HHS out there and they strong arm Reselucleff and they bring it in. And we have Danko, and now we are doing the clinical trials. And, you know, there's just all of this secrecy is going on to this day. And I was so excited when we had the last, I mean, not to bring it to the current last lawsuit with the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, but I was excited that we might finally get to see these original documents from those days, because they called it the record in the courts. That has been kept under lock and key for quite a number of years. And part of the reason was that the FDA sort of decided on their own that because there was violence and there was, like, you know, bombings and some other things, murders of doctors. I think there were 8 abortionists that had been killed. This is going in the 90s. So they decided that they were not going to release the names of the experts that would review the drug for the approval process. They were not going to release those names. And there's some interesting conversations, you know, that took place. But right out of the gate, the drug is approved in September 28th, 2000, after clinical trial. And so the movers and shakers are like University of California, Feminist Women's Foundation, Planned Parenthood, a lot of these same organizations that are around today. We even had one abortionist by the name of Tyrone Malloy, who did clinical trial in the 90s, who was in 2011 arrested and charged and jailed for Medicaid fraud. So, you know, wow. Take it for what it yeah. is, but he was part of clinical yep. trials in the 90s. And so the locations were public, because of course the women had to go there and all of this. But right out of the gate in 2000, once the pill is approved, we have this sort of change. And we see this, you know, even today with changing of the, you know, FDA approval, right? So they had a certain regimen in place, a certain dosage, and those dosage changes have been tweaked along the way.
Didn't they have to make some, like, I understand they had to actually change some definitions to get that original approval, right? They kind of pushed it through in the last year of the Clinton administration, right? I understand that in order to get it, in order to kind of fast track,
it was an emergency. Under like an emergency order, and, you know, that it wasn't, you know, and then the allegations in the lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court is that it wasn't ever tested on minors, and that it was done under this guise of pregnancy as an illness. Those were some of the allegations that were brought up.
Yeah.
But this pill, you know, it does get fast tracked. I think it's like 94. I forget. I think I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Maybe it started in 95, and in 5 years we have the drug approved. And of course, I might have that. It might have been longer, but that's about the time frame. And right out of the gate, we have this situation that happens in September of 2001. Now, keep in mind, September of 2001 should be ingrained in all of our minds, right? Because 9/11, yeah. Right? 9/11 That's happened right. in 2001. But in September of 2001, we have the first death that is attributed to the abortion pill. She was a woman from Canada. Now, I later found this really interesting interview with some journalists from Columbia University, where they brought together a whole host of these movers and shakers that were around in the 90s during clinical trial. And they started talking to them. And one of them, her name is Beverly Winnicoff. She was with the Population Council at the time. And she went on to found another organization called Genuity Health Projects, which is doing clinical trials to expand the abortion pill, mail order, and things we'll talk about later. Beverly Winnicoff is telling the journalists, and I'm paraphrasing on this part. She basically says, get this. This is the attitude of the people behind this drug. And she was involved in clinical trial for Population Council. She basically says 9/11 saved the abortion pill. And the reason she makes that statement is because the news of this death hits the media on 9/10. So she is quoted as saying it was September 10th. This is the day before 9/11, and that's what saved mifepristone, which is mifepristone 200 milligram is the approved abortion pill, right? She said there was a death reported. It was in the newspapers. If you go to the back pages, well, it was one death versus 3,000. That's her attitude, one death versus 3,000. She's not saying, oh, horrifyingly, this woman died. We need to get to the bottom of it. She's not concerned. It's just, oh my goodness, if this had just made the front pages, this would be horrible for the abortion pill. But thankfully, this death because of 9/11 got relegated to the back pages. So it's shockingly, this woman and many others started to suffer from this C. sordelli type infection that began to alarm FDA, began to alarm, and FDA sort of required at that time that Danco start publishing these warning letters to healthcare providers, where they would, you know, start letting healthcare providers and emergency people at hospitals know that, you know, there could be cases of ectopic pregnancy, risk of sepsis, blood infection. You don't never hear about sepsis nowadays, but that's, we'll get to that later. They noted that several deaths that were, quote, involved the off-label dosing of the abortion pill regimen were only in the early 2000s. And we're already off-label dosing, right? They added warnings involving the risk of serious bacterial infection, bleeding, and death. And in 2003, sad to say, we come across the story of Holly Patterson. She was an 18-year-old girl in California. She goes to Planned Parenthood. She buys the abortion, or she gets the abortion pill. Remember, back then, you had to pick it up at the location. You had to take it in front of a clinician. And then they required, although all women didn't necessarily do it, but they did require the prescribers request that you come back for a follow-up. So there were a lot more protections in place. And I will say, in fairness, the dosages have changed, so we're not talking apples and apples here. But Holly's family found her on the floor of their bathroom, and they rush her to the hospital, and she later dies from septic shock after her abortion pill experience. And her father, Monty Patterson, would go on. He'd never had thought about abortion. And this is something that anyone who's listening to this that's not pro-life, doesn't think about abortion, I want you to realize that this can touch your family, as it did in the case of Monty Patterson, whose 18-year-old daughter's gone. And he spent the next 20-some years begging the FDA to please put a halt on this drug. So you have that. Then you have this, like, I came across this really interesting letter to the editor that was published in Journal Contraception. And we can talk about Journal Contraception later, but they are not pro-life. They are so far on the other side, heavily pro-abortion, founded by an abortionist, the whole thing. And Philip Darney, who helped to found the whole Ryan residency program at the University of California, which trains abortionists. So he's a very well-established abortion doctor who's very well-respected in the University of California hospital system. He writes this letter to the editor, published there, and he basically says that the U.S. death rate was higher than in Europe, which had already approved the drug. And then he goes on to, you know, give you a reason. He said possibly because in the States, quote, U.S. physicians do not follow the FDA-approved instructions for using both drugs. So this is like just a few years post-approval. Wow. They're already going off-label. And so, you know, if you hear the term off-label, we can get into that too. the whole idea of progesterone being off label and all of the things that they've, you know, used to attack abortion pill reversal and other things. They did in the early days, they took the drug. So one of the things they were doing, for example, is the drug was, you know, to be either subliminal under the tongue or put into the cheeks of the mouth, especially the implementation of the drug. And they were starting to do vaginal insertion. So when they did these, they started calling together healthcare providers. They were holding lots of meetings, and even members of APWOG, the pro-life, you know, obstetrician gynecologist organization, Donna Harrison and others were watching and somewhat involved in some of these calls to try to investigate why this really serious deadly infection was just running rampant. And of course, in the end, it's still to this day, they don't know why. They'll just say that these deaths are attributed, but they can't be casually, absolutely, you know, the cause. They can't say for 100% sure the drug is the cause. But we are still hearing about deaths today, right? And sepsis and these other things. And so there's some speculation, was it that the woman may have introduced an infection by handling the drug? Where else do we hear about handling drugs, right? Today with, you know, some of these people walking them across our, from one state to another, and different people handling them, mailing them out,
another country. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like walking other countries across the border. Yep.
Nobody's sounding the alarm on any of this, but there's speculation all over the board as to why. And they were never able to really understand the whole mechanism behind this infection. And so, you know, so in 2011, because they were still investigating these things, the FDA determined that it was necessary to put this under a safety system, which is known by the acronym of REMS, which stands for Risk Evaluation Mitigation Strategy. It's so that the FDA could study, keep a close eye on what's going on. And this is where they started to require that the DANCO report all adverse events and deaths. And that went on for a number of years where these adverse events and deaths were reported to be.
As I remember, the kind of the implementation of the pill from a percentage basis, right? So in 2001, it's really when it begins to hit the market, you know, as far as from the FDA approval. And in the very beginning, the first year or so, we see like maybe 1%. But remember, back in those times, you know, abortions were still over a million abortions a year. 1% is still 10,000 women, right? If we're talking about 1% of a million, it's still 10,000. But by the time we get to 2011, we are at about 11%, as I recall. So now we're talking about 100,000 women or thereabouts who now are subject to these things for which they still don't have answers. You know, is the pill really as safe and effective as it is? So you're saying the FDA at that point begins to introduce more stringent structure and require more reporting. Does that actually happen?
Yeah, there has been some reviews of those adverse events. They're very sloppy. You know, I've seen a few of them because they come up through the prescriber. So keep in mind that there was no mail order. You were going to the facility. Now, the important thing to understand with the percentages that you were just talking about is that no, women were not biting at the bit to get this drug. The marketing of the drug and the media compliance with the marketing of the drug is what's bringing women to getting this drug now. But back in the day, they were very much would prefer to have a surgical abortion. It's quick. The surgical abortion is done in a day. You can go under anesthesia. And the other thing that they were really surprised about is that more doctors, because originally it was, of course, doctors that would prescribe it, and then it morphed into clinicians, which would be anybody who could prescribe in any state. So it depended on your state. But the doctors were not running to prescribe this drug either. And Dan, you know, abortionists like Dan Grossman is involved in clinical trials, has talked about this multiple different times. And it's been mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, you know, Washington Post back in those days. They were not running to prescribe this drug. And then once it went under the system called REMS, the prescriber, in order to prescribe the drug, you literally had to sign a prescriber agreement with DANCO. And so it was just DANCO at the time. And that scared a lot of people. They did not want to be on a quote list. They did not want, you know, if you're just like an average OB-GYN and you're just like, well, maybe I'll do it for my patients. Now you're going to be on a list. You're going to be labeled an abortionist. And they ran the other direction. And this is the reason we're seeing what's happening, you know, currently is they're trying to get out from under this sort of guideline, because a lot of people were spooked by that, you know, being on a list. Now, I've contacted the FDA multiple times. The FDA, that list is only in the hands of Danco. Danco, and now their generic, which was later approved in 2019, Gem BioPro, are the only ones that can certify a prescriber or decertify. They have all policing power. So even though it's under this more stringent system, the FDA very rarely, if any, there's really no, like, you know, there's nothing that happens to Danco when they don't comply with anything, because there's specific things that this REMS requires, which is that they require that all prescribers be able to properly date a pregnancy, that they can rule out deadly ectopic pregnancy, they can provide emergency care in the event of a complication, or refer to someone who can. And so, you know, back in the day when it was licensed abortion facilities like, you know, Planned Parenthood, your typical facilities that had plenty of surgical abortion equipment, this was more common, where they could just say if a woman was experiencing, she didn't fully expel the baby, they could just bring her in and do a surgical abortion. But that has completely changed.
Well, and these are common sense protections for women, right? That's the point. Now, we know that the child, of course, is not protected under any circumstances, but the women, these are the kind of common sense things that are in place, although, frankly, like you said, loosely policed, but are in place until we get in kind of into the modern era, which is really what I want to cover in the next our next episode. We knew this would be a big topic, and I appreciate, Carol, you kind of kept us from going down some rabbit trails, because there are some even more interesting things kind of that are working in the same time frame. But as we kind of close this, it's really setting the table for kind of some modern things that we're now facing, and that includes some very powerful entities that are kind of pseudo government, kind of, or are acting as kind of pseudo government players, who have tremendous influence into the medical community, in particular amongst the OB-GYNs and all of how things are being done, and as well as more shenanigans at the FDA, which happens kind of has happened in recent years for us. So let's get to that next episode, and I look forward to hearing more about that.
All right. Well, thank you, Jarrell. Thank you, Carol, for all of your research and sharing that with us. There's obviously a lot of ground to cover, and so we'll continue on in part two. So I hope our listeners are subscribed to the podcast so that you get the update when that episode is released. Also hope that you're sharing this with others, because this history is so important to know and to share. So with that, subscribe, share, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Pregnancy Help Podcast.